supposed to wear this.
Let's see. So all the good jokes are missing. There are not going to be any more jokes. So I'm going to sharpen the approach with a statement of three problems. So as I said, we're thinking about 11-dimensional supergravity on an oriented spin manifold Y. The basic fields are a metric, a C field, which is at least initially a three form on Y. So this is my notation for three forms on Y. And it generalizes the potential, the gauge potential of electromagnetism. And so the field strength, G, is just the exterior derivative. It's four form on Y. And the gravitino, which plays an important role, but will, in this talk, be suppressed. We'll have our hands full just understanding the C field. The action for 11-dimensional supergravity is some standard terms, and then a very interesting Chern-Simons term. And that's what this talk is all about. So roughly speaking, the Chern-Simons term looks like this. It's a 6CGG minus CIA. IA is a certain quartic polynomial in the Riemann curvature. And problem one is find a mathematically precise definition of this Chern-Simons phase when G is cohomologically non-trivial and when Y itself has a boundary. You see, when G is non-trivial, then C doesn't exist globally. So what do you mean by this? If you try and extend to 12 dimensions, well, you can't do that when Y has a boundary. So, and that 1/6 and similar coefficients in the I8, which is lambda squared minus P2 over 48, make the definition a little subtle, even without a boundary. Okay, so we'll answer that question. Now, the second problem is the formulation of the Gauss law and C field electric charge, and that splits into two sub-problems. So the idea is once you've got the action for 11-dimensional supergravity, then you can contemplate this standard wave function of the universe type situation where you have an 11-manifold Y with a boundary X. You specify some boundary condition Cx on the boundary, and you ask, what is the wave function as a function of Cx on the boundary? That's the integral over all extensions to Y. And because of the Chern-Simons phase, formulating the gauge invariance of that wave function is non-trivial, as you'll see. And the first question is, what conditions on C sub x do we have to have for a non-vanishing gauge invariant wave function? So the basic idea is that essentially the electric charge has to be zero in x. X is compact. But I'm going to give you a very precise formulation. If the electric charge is not zero, then you can't have a physical wave function for C sub x, non-zero. And a close analogy to bear in mind here is three-dimensional U1 Chern-Simons gauge theory. So we can have a Chern-Simons term here with coefficient k, which is quantized. And if you like, you can add a standard term. The Gauss law in this case tells you that the field strength has to be zero. The cohomology class of the field strength on the boundary Riemann surface has to be zero. And indeed, in the limit as g squared Young-Mills goes to infinity, you recover Chern-Simons theory. And then the full Gauss law tells you that F equals zero. Suitably interpreted, this leads to all the lovely mathematics of a section of a line bundle over the moduli space of flat connections and so on. So we want to generalize this from three dimensions to 11 dimensions. And problem 2b is the closely related problem is how do you define the electric charge of the C field? So I remind you that in electromagnetism in n dimensions, the equation of motion is just d star f equals j. And the cohomology class of j in a spatial slice x is the electric charge. So if x is compact, it had better vanish. The total charge in the universe should vanish. Now, in M theory, the Chern-Simons term is cubic. And so the C field theory is nonlinear. Here's its equation of motion. And what that means is that background metrics here and C fields here induce electric charge for the C field. because the right-hand side of this equation, just like here, is the electric charge. And so we know that the electric charge is in degree 8 Durham cohomology class is a half g squared minus I8. But in M theory, because of brains and so on, electric charge should be an integral cohomology class. And so what we'd like to do is find an element in the integral cohomology of degree 8, which is lifting this. So problem 2b is to give a precise definition of the electric charge, and we'll do that. Now, problem 3 is the main motivation for me for working on this problem, and that is understanding better the emergence of E8 gauge symmetry in M theory. So we know that on singular K3 surfaces, we can get enhanced E8 gauge symmetries. We know that in the Hoje-Witten construction, on the 10-dimensional boundaries, we get E8 gauge symmetries. And also in 1996, as part of a spin-off of this Hoje-Witten work, Witten gave a definition of the Chern-Simons phase that used E8 gauge theory in 12 dimensions. I'll review it below. And this definition was then further used to establish a connection to the K-theory classification of Ramond-Ramon fluxes in the limit that M-theory reduces to type 2 string theory. So all of this points to some interesting E8 structure in 11-dimensional M-theory. And we'd like to get at it. That's not a very precise question. The best I can ask here is, what is the precise relation of the C-field to an E8 gauge field? And I will give an answer to that question. I don't know if it's the best answer, but I'll certainly give an answer. OK, so those are three motivating problems. Are there any questions? OK. So now I want to discuss what is a C-field. And so the next set of transparencies has a lot of overlap with what Mike Hopkins was discussing last week, but the audience here is not quite the same as last week. So. Perhaps it's not irrelevant to mention some of this. So what I'm going to do is, first I'm going to describe the gauge invariant information in a C-field. And let's warm up with Maxwell's theory. So how do you describe the gauge equivalence class of a U1 gauge field on a manifold M? What's the gauge invariant information in a U1 gauge field? And the answer is, all the gauge invariant information is encoded in the holonomy around all 1 cycles. So if I know, here's the holonomy, chi checks of A of gamma is the holonomy of A around gamma. If I know the holonomy around all 1 cycles, I know the gauge equivalence class of A. So let's regard the holonomy as a map from 1 cycles to the group U1. And now let's ask how the holonomy for a gauge field differs from an arbitrary such map. And the answer is that in the case that there exists a gauge field, this map has the following property. There exists a closed 2 form with 2 pi integral periods. This is my notation for that. Closed 2 forms with 2 pi integral periods. Let's call it F. Such that if gamma bounds a disk, then you can evaluate the holonomy around gamma by the integral of this ordinary differential form F over the disk. Okay. Now, maps that satisfy this property star are in one-to-one correspondence with U1 gauge bundles with connection. So the generalization of that to P-form gauge fields is the theory of Cheeger-Simons characters. So the definition is a Cheeger-Simons character, chi-check in h-check p plus 1. My notation, unfortunately, differs slightly from Mike here. I think Mike would have called it h-check upper p. A Cheeger-Simons character, chi-check, is a homomorphism from the p cycles on M into U1, such that there exists a field strength, omega of chi-check, which is a p plus 1 form with integral periods necessarily closed. And what it means to have a field strength is that if sigma is the boundary of a p plus 1 chain, then the holonomy around sigma sub p is the integral of the ordinary differential form on the chain. Okay? That's a notion that takes a little bit of getting used to if you haven't seen it before. And the basic message is that the gauge equivalence class of a p-form gauge field is a differential character. Now, since I know it's unfamiliar to many physicists, let me say a little bit more about how you describe a Cheeger-Simons character, the gauge invariant information here. And there are two ways of expressing that gauge invariant information. There's a sequence in terms of two exact sequences in these two blue boxes here. The first is what I call the sequence for flat characters. So because to a Cheeger-Simons character, somebody in here, we can always associate its field strength. We have a map from here to here. The kernel of this map is the space of flat characters, those with omega equals zero. The kernel of that is this finite dimensional space, the Pth cohomology with UN coefficients. Then there's another sequence, which I call the sequence for topologically trivial characters, which goes like this. Supposing I have a globally well-defined P form, it's like a gauge field on a trivial connection, a trivial bundle. Then if this is globally well-defined, I can certainly define a character by just taking the periods of A over sigma and exponentiating. So notice that this character only depends on A modulo P forms with integral periods. And notice that the field strength by Stokes' theorem is just dA, and it's trivial in cohomology. So what we have here is a map from the topologically trivial characters, omega mod omega p sub z, this infinite dimensional space, into the space of all characters. And the quotient is p plus one dimensional cohomology, turns out with integral coefficients. And these two sequences are compatible in the following sense. If I have a character, I have associated to it this integral cohomology class. I'll call that the characteristic class of the character. And the real image of the characteristic class is the Durham cohomology class of the differential form of the field strength. Okay? Now, at this point, many physicists will be muttering, why do we need all this? And let me try and indicate that. So the point is that the Cheeger-Simons character captures torsion information, which is invisible in the world of differential forms. So what can happen is you can have a non-trivial p-cycle such that n times that p-cycle is a boundary. Well, if n times the p-cycle is a boundary, then you can certainly evaluate the nth power of the holonomy. It's just an integral of an ordinary differential form over that boundary. But taking that nth square root, taking that nth root of this formula involves torsion information. And the extra data in the Cheeger-Simons character tells us how to take that nth root. And I should also mention at this point that the Pth cohomology with U1 coefficients looks like this. It's a disjoint union of tori. The torus is just the real cohomology divided by the lattice of forms with integral periods. And the number of components is given by the order of the torsion group in 1 degree higher. Okay. So these Cheeger-Simons characters come up all over in physics. H1 check of M is just the space of U1 valued functions on M. You see, if you have a function phi check from M to U1 and you have a zero cycle, then the holonomy, if you like, around the zero cycle is simply the product of the phases to the nth power at the different points. The field strength is the logarithmic derivative of phi. And the characteristic class is just the pullback of the fundamental class on U1, dt. And in physics, H1 check of M, the space of U1 valued functions on M, is going to be the gauge group of electromagnetism. That's the way it's going to appear in this talk. H2 check of M, as I've just explained, is the space of gauge equivalence classes of line bundles with connection. H3 check of M is the space of gauge equivalence classes of gerb connections, or B fields. We won't say much about that. And H4 check of M is what this talk is about, the membrane coupling of M theory. So let's motivate that. In Maxwell theory, a charged particle of charge E moving on a world line gamma couples via the Wilson line. In M theory, there are electrically charged membranes whose three-dimensional world volume, sigma, couples to the C field in this way. Okay, so the coupling of how do we measure the gauge invariant information in a C field? That's measured by the coupling to all possible world volume sigma. So for every sigma, I give you a phase. That's gauge invariant. That summarizes the gauge invariant information in C, and so we conclude that the gauge equivalence class of C is a Cheeger-Simons 4 character. Well, I lied a little. There's a slight subtlety there. More accurately, there are fermions on the membrane, so the topologically interesting part of the coupling of the C field to the membrane involves the square root of a determinant for the fermions on the membrane. This has a sign problem which must be canceled by the sign problem here. So the more accurate statement is that the difference of two C fields is a Cheeger-Simons 4 character. Because of these fermion determinants, C is actually what's known as a shifted differential character. That means its field strength is not quite the image of a cohomology class, integral cohomology class A, but is shifted by 1/2 lambda, where lambda is the canonical class associated to a spin structure on Y. So the conclusion, what is a C field? Well, a partial answer is that its gauge equivalence class is in this shifted differential cohomology group. But I didn't answer the question that I set out to answer. What I asked was, what is a C field? Not, what is this gauge equivalence class? The analogy here is that it's like I formulated non-abelian gauge theory on the space of gauge potentials mod gauge transformations. I formulated in terms of gauge invariant information. But locality forces us to introduce gauge potentials. We want to introduce gauge potentials. So how do we resolve this? Well, physicists don't even bother with all this. They usually think of a C field as a three form on Y. And there's gauge. What's the gauge group? Well, there's small C field gauge transformations where we shift C by D of a two form. And all gauge transformations, all in quotes, because we're going to change that, C is shifted by a three-form with integral periods omega. And this is a perfectly fine point of view if C lives in this space, which you might recall is the space of topologically trivial differential characters, if its gauge equivalence class does. Now, but many interesting phenomena in string theory and M theory involve topologically non-trivial characters, after all. Five brains, ADS, CFT, all of that involves cohomologically non-trivial G-floats. So I will introduce a model, the E8 model for the C field, which seems to be well suited to introducing these gauge potentials for the C field, which is well suited to formulating the action. It's motivated by Witten's definition of the M theory action as an integral in 12 dimensions, which I will review below. And it's based on the topological fact or accident or coincidence, I don't know, that there's a homotopy equivalence between E8 and KZ3, or if you like, BE8 and KZ4, up to the 15 skeleton. And so what that means is that if you have a manifold of dimension less than or equal to 15, then there's a one-to-one correspondence between a cohomology class, an integral cohomology class of degree 4, and an isomorphism class of a principal E8 bundle over M. So, although it's not mathematically natural, for convenience, I will for each A, I will pick a specific E8 bundle. I'll call it P of A over M. And my definition of a C field, in this talk, a C field means the following. A C field on Y with characteristic class A is a pair of a connection on a principal E8 bundle and an ordinary three form. So there'll be pairs, big A, little c. I'll call little c the little C field. And that's what a C field will mean for me. And I'll sometimes use capital C check as the notation for this. So that's what a C field is. Are there any questions?
Yeah. What are the dimensions
of Y? Y is still 11 dimensions. That's actually a nice question, because I'll also introduce this space E sub P of X. So I'll talk about C fields in 10 dimensions. When Y has a boundary, I'll talk about E sub P of X and C fields on X. Y could be up to 15 dimensional, but we apparently don't need it.
I was more concerned about going down. What do you factify in theory?
That's not a problem. That's not a problem. It's the same. Yeah.
E7
comes close. No. The answer is no if you want to work in 11 dimensions. E7 comes close, but doesn't make it. So E8 is uniquely singled out by this. Yeah?
Another question. So the usual way of...
Of course, Gary, if you want it to work in lower dimensions, you could use you can play a little silly game where you say, suppose E7, how high could I go? And it's like 10 dimensions or something like that. Yeah? Yeah. Well, no. It's more because of the torsion information that you shouldn't think of it as just a differential form. And then there's a further subtlety that C is not only a Cheeger-Simon. You see, the difference of two C fields, okay, is a Cheeger-Simon's character, an honest Cheeger-Simon's character. And that carries torsion information, which is not just there in a three form. Okay. But then on top of that, there's another subtlety that C is a shifted differential character. So that is rather important. So that if you actually try and talk about the holonomy of C around sigma, that's not well defined up to a sign. You see, you could take the sigma and you could make here's sigma. You could make a family of sigmas over an S1. And you'll come back to yourself with a minus sign if the integral of g over this sigma times S1 is pi, which can really happen because its quantization is involves a half lambda. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think I now understand your question. So you can play that game. You can introduce an atlas and talk about C alpha and B alpha beta and gamma alpha beta gamma and so on. I think it gets very awkward. I think in principle you could do that. You could give a kind of check description.
Also, I mean, this is what the E8 bundle explains.
That's right.
You could work with this, but you have this integrality property.
Yeah, yeah. That I think that'll become a little clearer when I talk about the action. I think even with the shift in the quantization, you could give a check description. I just find it a little awkward. I mean, well, I think even with the shift, there should be a check description.
I think there are a lot of different models. I mean, Mike's lectures have completely different proportions. But at some point, in a few slides, there will be an integrality property to explain, and you can choose which model will explain it.
Yeah, I did actually put the stress on A. I say I'm giving a model for the C field. And I don't know if it's the best model. I mean, it works well for some things. It might not work well for others. Okay, that's a C field. Now, let me... No. Well, yeah. The theorem is that there's a one-to-one correspondence with integral cohomology classes and isomorphism classes of principal E8 bundles. And that's why I do this mathematically unnatural thing of for each A, I pick a specific bundle. I'll make some choices. Then you worry about automorphisms. Those can be dealt with. I'm trying to simplify the presentation. I can explain to you later how to deal with it. No, absolutely not. Because a C field is a connection in a three form. So that is what a C field is in this talk. A pair of a connection on the E8 bundle. I'm trying to replace the C field by a connection on an E8 bundle in some sense. okay? But I actually what I'm doing is a connection and an honest-to-God three-form, globally defined. Okay, so how do we go from the C field to its gauge equivalence class? And that is to say, what's the coupling of a C field in this formulation to a membrane? And here's the coupling. So if the membrane wraps capital sigma, then the holonomy of the C field around sigma is the exponentiated Chern-Simons invariant of A plus the integral of the ordinary C field, ordinary free form, little c. And then that shift I discussed is accounted for by subtracting half of the Chern-Simons invariant of the spin connection, omega. So I'm giving here the very precise normalizations. And it follows from Stokes' theorem that the field strength of this C field, G, expressed in this language is trace F squared minus half trace R squared plus D of little c. Okay, so the slogan here is that the C field is really like the Chern-Simons form of the E8 gauge field, but this formula should not be taken literally for many reasons, which I can explain to interested people later. And the whole point of this formalism that I'm explaining is to write a version of that which is really true. Okay, so now I've told you what the space of C fields is, how to map it to the gauge invariant information. So now what we want to do is we want to look for a gauge group, curly G, such that the quotient of the space of C field gauge potentials by the gauge group is the gauge invariant space. So the gauge group orbit are pairs A and C such that they lead to the same coupling to the membrane. So what's the solution of this? Well, the solution is the following. A prime and A can be any two connections on the same principal E8 bundle. That just means they differ by alpha. Alpha is a one form in the adjoint representation. Okay, if A prime and A are related that way, then little c prime is related to little c by the relative Chern-Simons invariant from A to A prime plus a three form with integral periods. So, so this is what all physicists know. These are the C field gauge transformations, possibly large C field gauge transformations. This stuff is just stuff that is there because I've added all these E8 gauge connections. So you might conclude that the gauge group is just the product of one forms in the adjoint representation and three forms with integral periods. And this is a group, and here's its action, but it's unsatisfactory for two reasons. This is a little subtle. And I'll explain that physically and mathematically. The physical explanation is the following. In electromagnetism, if you have a manifold Y with a boundary, so you have Y with boundary X, and you have a charged particle which is ending on a point P and X, and you consider the coupling to the gauge field and make a gauge transformation, of course it's not gauge invariant. It changes by the value of the gauge group at P. Now I remind you that the gauge group of electromagnetism is H1 check of X. Okay, so in M theory, everything's moved up 2 degrees. So the open membrane, which ends on a 2-cycle here, is also going to be not gauge invariant, and it's going to change by a phase associated to every 2-cycle in X. So by this reasoning, you expect the gauge group should be H3 check of X. Now, I remind you that H3 check of X is not quite the same as three forms with integral periods. This is what physicists usually say is the C field gauge group. There's an extension here by the flat characters, the two forms with U1 coefficients. Sorry, the degree 2 cohomology with U1 coefficients. I will call these new gauge transformations micro gauge transformations for the following reason. Here's the gauge group. This is the group we're really going to take. Here's the action on a C field. Shifts A, shifts little c by the relative Chern-Simons term, and adds the field strength of that Cheeger-Simons 3 character. Now you see, if I take a micro gauge transformation, then this is zero, so it doesn't do anything. So you think it's totally stupid. It doesn't actually move the C field. But it will act non-trivially in quantum mechanics, and it will be very important later. So this is a subtlety we missed for a long time. Now it's also, that's the physical reason, and it's also mathematically natural. This is for the, strictly for the mathematicians. If you have a G action on a space, E of Y, then you can associate, you can form a groupoid where the objects are the C fields and the morphisms are the gauge transformations between two C fields. That's a groupoid. And the objects in that category have an automorphism group, which is H2 with U1 coefficients, because micro gauge transformations don't move the C field. Now, Hopkins and Singer have a theory of differential cochains that Mike explained last week. This can be applied to the C field of M theory, and the space of shifted differential cocycles is also a category. And the theorem is, if we take this as our gauge group, then there's an equivalence of categories. And if we didn't take that as our gauge group, there wouldn't be. Okay, so that's what a C field is in this talk. And now let me make two remarks. First, the formalism makes clear the physical role of the E8 gauge field. It's a kind of a topological field theory. You see, I can shift A to any other connection A prime. If the bundle, if the E8 bundle is non-trivial, if the cohomology class of the G-flux is non-trivial, I can't put A to 0 because it's a connection on a non-trivial bundle. But I can shift it around from any connection to any other connection. It's a little like Donaldson-Witten theory, where you can shift A by psi, except that psi was nilpotent in the previous case. So that's the first remark. And now you could ask, well, what about ordinary E8 gauge transformations, where I just take an actual bundle automorphism and take A to AG? And what about those? And the answer is, those transformations are certainly inside the gauge group that I described. So alpha would just be the difference of AG and A. The construction of Kaichek is a little interesting, but let's skip it. And so they certainly sit inside these gauge transformations. But the interesting point here is that they sit not as a subgroup, but as a subgroupoid. So if the green dots are the different C fields, and the arrows means a gauge transformation, that's a picture of this groupoid. And so what I'm saying is that ordinary E8 gauge transformations are a subset of the arrows. That'll come back at the end of the talk. Okay, now we know what a C field is. Let's write down the action of 11-dimensional supergravity. And here's the answer. Here's the Chern-Simons phase. So it's expressed in terms of an eta invariant. So you see, if I have an E8 gauge field, I can couple it to a Dirac operator. I can form the eta invariant of that Dirac operator, or better, xi, and exponentiate it. There's a similar term for the gravitational field. And then there's a purely local term, which I've written here. OK, so I claim that that is the action, the Chern-Simons term, and the action of 11-dimensional supergravity. OK, well, first of all, you check that it's gauge invariant under this gauge group that I've explained. And that's a straightforward check. Now, you're probably wondering, what in the world does that have to do with the standard term in 11-dimensional supergravity? And the answer is obtained by relating it to Witten's definition. So suppose that my bundle in 11 dimensions admits an extension to a bounding 12 manifold. Let's call it P sub Z of A sub Z over a bounding 12 manifold. And supposing that I can extend my C field in 11 dimensions to a C field in 12 dimensions, then the expression that I just wrote on the previous slide is 1/6 g cubed minus gia up to a minus sign. Let's not worry about the minus sign. Where g is the usual thing, trace f squared, that should be a half trace r squared plus dc. And the proof of this is based on the remarkable observation of Witten that if you take this density, everybody recognizes this side as the standard Chern-Simons term, I hope. Ask now. OK, you don't. right, because this is very important. Can anybody see this? So if I have 1/6 of CG squared on 11 manifold, that's the integral over the bounding 12 manifold, 1/6 of G cubed. That's all I'm saying. Okay. Now, Witten observed that if you take 1/6 G cubed minus GIA and make this identification here, then that can be written in terms of the index density of a Dirac operator in 12 dimensions, plus a similar gravitational term, where you take the 12 form part. Well, all you do now is you apply the APS index theorem to this. So this is an index density on a manifold with boundary. Apply the APS index theorem, and you get this expression in terms of eta invariance. Now, the reason this is an improvement is that it's expressed purely in terms of data intrinsic to y. And I do not need to extend into 12 dimensions. So this is intrinsically defined in terms of the fields on y. And that means that I can immediately go to the case of a manifold with boundary. Because here's where the formalism comes into its own. You can't use this trick of extending to 12 dimensions when y has a boundary. And so, but you can use this formula. So the phase, the answer is that the Trent-Simons term in the 11-dimensional supergravity action is given by this eta invariant plus some local stuff. No. No, I am not introducing, it's very interesting, but I'm not introducing any physical spinners. I have a gauge field, so I can couple it to a Dirac operator and take its eta invariant. Yeah. But the fields are just the C field. I'm just talking about the C field. And in particular, you might think that this is somehow the Gravitino determinant. Right. No. The Gravitino determinant also has its eta invariant. It's another determinant. It has to be added into the whole story. But I certainly have had that dream, and I think other people have had this dream, where the C field is some composite, low-energy composite field, and there's some underlying theory, and you've integrated out fermions in the adjoint of E8, and they have a phase, which is this eta invariant. Certainly, one can imagine that. You have a little problem with the real part of that determinant, which is non-local and doesn't quite work. But no, this is just about the C field. Okay, now, that's the answer to the question of what's the action on a manifold with boundary, but there's a very conceptually important distinction that I've snuck in here. Because when you have an eta invariant on a manifold with boundary, and I've learned this from Dai and Fried's paper, the eta invariant is not giving a U just a phase. It's giving you a section of a U1 bundle. So the U1 bundle is over the space of all C fields. I'll call it Q. And it's a little subtle. It has the following property. Every time I have an extension CY of CX, so I have an extension of my C field on the boundary to 11 dimensions, I get an actual element in the total space of the bundle over CX. If I have, but that's a section of a line of a circle bundle. It's not an actual well-defined phase. If I have two extensions, then I can take CX and I have CY here and CY prime here, then I can glue them together to make a closed manifold. If I take the quotient of two sections, phi of CY over phi of CY prime, that's an honest-to-God U1 phase, not a section of a line bundle. That phase is the M-theory phase of this closed manifold I just made by gluing. Okay, now because of that description, it turns out there's a very natural connection on this bundle. Let's not worry about definition. The one thing I want to stress about that connection is that it has non-zero curvature. And here's the curvature. This is a curvature of a U1 bundle over the space of C fields. It's not zero. It's a two-form. You see delta C, delta C. So it's a two-form on that space. And it's not zero when the flux is non-zero. Okay. So at this point, let me stress, I've now completely solved problem one. I've told you exactly what the action of 11-dimensional supergravity is, including arbitrary topology and manifolds of boundary. What do we do with it? Well, the first thing we want to do with it is imitate three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory and say something about the wave function of the C field, if you like the wave function of the universe or the C field's contribution to it, when X is bounded by Y. So let's fix an extension of the bundle on X to Y. And for a fixed C field on X, we consider the set of all extensions, and then we integrate over all of those. And that defines our wave function. So what can we say about this wave function? Well, the first thing is that it's a sum of phases in a U1 bundle, Q. So it's valued in the line bundle associated to Q. And then because of the definition in terms of eta invariance, that line bundle is just the Pfaffian line bundle for E8 fermions. You see, it's very much like what you were asking. It's the Pfaffian line bundle for E8 fermions on the boundary, even though I have not introduced any fermions. Okay. Now, the most fundamental thing about these wave functions is that they should be gauge invariant. And here's the statement of gauge invariance. It says that the gauge group, that's the funny gauge group I introduced before, which I'm just calling G, acting on psi of Cx is psi of gauge transform of Cx. But think about it. Psi is now a section of a non-trivial line bundle. So what we need to do is we need to define a lifting of the group action on the space of C fields to the group action on the line bundle. So to preview the next several slides, we'll define that lift, and then I'll look at the case of micro-gauge transformations. Those keep the C field fixed, and so we want to have G dot psi equals psi, and this will be a non-trivial condition which will imply the vanishing C field electric charge in the 10-manifold boundary. And the full Gauss laws, I'll indicate, is what's is really the quantization of what's known in physics as the Page charge. The analogy to three-dimensional U1 level K Chern-Simons theory is this. The Gauss law, the analog of the vanishing of electric charge, says that the characteristic class of the U1 bundle is zero. Then the field strength has to be zero, and the Wilson lines, or Ferlinda operators, have to be K torsion. Okay, so the first point is that there does exist a well-defined lift of this group to L. And the hard part is to construct the action of these large C field gauge transformations associated with chi check. And so remember, they're taking A in little c to A in little c plus omega. And so how do we define a lift? Well, what we have, the natural thing to do to try and define a lift is to use the connection that exists on the bundle. So if I'm Can people see here? So here's my space. Well, here's my space of C fields. Here's the line. Here's Cx. Here's G dot Cx. I need to define an action from here. I need to get over here. Well, the most natural thing to do is to choose a path, P, and use the connection to lift that path. So this is the parallel transport, U sub P, of some vector psi goes to U sub P of psi. So that's the first thing you try. And you see, it doesn't quite work because the line bundle has curvature. So the first thing you try is you lift the path. But now you have to introduce a correction factor in order to implement the group law. The problem is that if you first make a gauge transformation by, say, omega chi 2 here, and then another one chi 1 here, that's different from taking making a gauge transformation of chi 1 plus chi 2. That's along here. We're taking a linear path, I should say. And the reason it's different is that the line bundle has curvature. So the holonomy around this triangle is not zero, and it's given by this. So here's how we correct it to get an honest group lift. And I'll just give you the idea. We're given a C field on a 10-manifold X. And we're given a gauge transformation, chi check and H3 check. So what we're going to do is we're going to make a new C field, a twisted character, on Y, which is X times S1. So we're going to glue, we're going to cross X with the interval, and we're going to glue it on one side to the other side by making that C field gauge transformation to produce a C field on the 11-manifold X times S1. And then we're going to take the M-theory phase on that. And so it turns out that that's exactly the cocycle relation that we need. That satisfies the cocycle relation that we need, and it cancels the curvature. Okay, so let's skip the details of that construction. So we have a group lift, and so now we reconsider this action here, and now we look at the micro gauge transformation. So when chi check is flat, that's omega is zero, then the C field goes to itself, but I said it wasn't stupid. It would act non-trivially on this line. Here's where it's not stupid. It can act non-trivially on the line over that C field. So that is to say, the action on a wave function can give you this non-trivial correction factor on psi. And that can be a non-trivial phase. And that phase is defined in terms of the M-theory phase, which is defined in terms of eta invariance of Dirac operators coupled to E8 gauge fields. So gauge invariance requires that this phi be 1 for all flat chi, that is, for all micro gauge transformations. The cocycle law that I flashed before shows that if I hold C check fixed and chi is flat, then this is just a homomorphism from H2 with U1 coefficients to U1. So by Poincaré duality, it's the pairing with an degree 8 integral cohomology class, which I'll call theta of C. And so there's the conclusion. This is the mathematical definition of theta. This is the integral Gauss law. That theta must vanish in order to have a non-zero gauge invariant wave function of the C field. It's the analog of C1 of P equals 0 in Chern-Simons theory. So now I want to interpret it. I want to interpret this capital theta of C as the C field electric charge. And I can do that by considering the situation where I insert an open membrane ending on sigma here and consider the gauge invariance in this new situation. And we saw before that that the gauge group now acts with an extra phase, chi check of little sigma, which I can write as e to the 2 pi Poincaré dual of sigma. That's an integral 8 form. A class paired with chi check. That's appearing in exactly the same way as capital theta right here. And so it's reasonable to interpret theta as the C field electric charge induced by the background metric and C field. Okay, so that is the solution of problem 2b. Okay, I've now told you, I've defined in a very precise way an integral class of degree A, which is the electric charge induced by the metric and the C field. What do we know about it? Well, the first important consistency check is that it is indeed an integral lift of a half g squared minus i8, and that's an easy calculation. But it's an integral class. So first of all, it being an integral class, it can only depend on the characteristic class of C check. And we know that g is quantized in terms of a minus a half lambda, so theta of a is 1 half a minus lambda plus 30 a hat. So an interesting mathematical spin off of this is that on a spin 10 manifold, 30 a hat has a natural integral lift. And I've asked many of the best topologists in the world what that could be, and I still haven't gotten an answer. But there's some natural lift of 30 a hat. What else do we know about theta of A? Not a whole lot. We know it has a certain cobordism invariance. We know it satisfies a bilinear identity. It's a quadratic refinement of the cup product on four classes. And we also know that it satisfies parity invariance. So theta of lambda minus A is theta of A. So you can compute theta in some examples. So what that means, for example, is you can do things like take a four-sphere times a product of lens spaces, turn on some g-flux, torsion g-flux on those lens spaces, and that induces non-zero electric charge, non-zero C-field electric charge. You can show that. The rest of the Gauss law is the electromagnetic dual of this quantization of the g-flux. This is what we all know. But there's a little more to the quantization of g-flux, and that's the quantization of page charges. So let me explain that. So when the electric charge is zero, then a half g squared minus I8 can be trivialized. And let's just call a half c wedge g minus I7 the trivialization of that. And then the equation of motion tells us that d of this 7 form is zero. So that means that there's a Durand class of degree 7, which is conserved. And this is known in physics as the page charge. Now, star G is essentially the canonical momentum. And the canonical momentum shifts the C field. So e to the omega pi is C plus omega. But the Gauss law tells me how the wave function behaves under shifts of large C field gauge transformations. You put that together, and you get the quantization of the page charge. Now, where this topology pays off is in a little surprise. It turns out that because of subtleties of this correction factor, the page charge is not integrally quantized, as you might have expected from the fact that membranes come with charge 1, but is half integrally quantized. So topology can introduce, if you like, half integral charges, half integral page charges. OK, so let me say, go briefly over some applications of this. The first is to the five-brain partition function. So in addition to electrically charged membranes, there are, of course, magnetically charged five-brains. And in this talk, I've been talking about 11-dimensional supergravity. So we're approaching these five-brains from the outside in, so to speak. So I'm going to cut out a little tubular neighborhood around the five brain and ask about what is the reaction of supergravity to the presence of that five brain. So when I cut out that tubular neighborhood, the boundary is a 10 manifold, the kind of 10 manifold I've been discussing, which itself is a four-sphere bundle over the world volume of the five brain. And what we've been talking about so far is the wave function of the C field, which is a section of a line bundle over the space of C fields on that boundary. Now, the five-brain partition function is some kind of wave function of is some kind of section of a line bundle over the space of C fields on W6. Now, the full partition function of supergravity with a five-brain should be the product of the path integral of supergravity outside the five-brain and the partition function of the five-brain. So under some identification of C fields on W6 with C fields on this 10-dimensional boundary, we should be able to take the product of these wave functions, and that's gauge invariant. And that's the statement of anomaly inflow. So from this, you see that this five-brain line bundle must be the dual of the C-field line bundle. And this, in fact, is the idea behind the first of two definitions that Witten gave for the five-brain partition function. He said this in words. So that was his first proposal in 96. And now in the same paper, actually, he actually gave a second, what you might call an intrinsic definition of the five-brain partition function, which was then subsequently studied by him and by Hopkins and Singer. That just uses the data on the five-brain world volume. It just uses, it says you have a six manifold, and you have a chiral two form on the six manifold, and so on. However, to give such an intrinsic definition, you must be able to decouple the 5 brain from the bulk 11-dimensional M theory. I should say. It was subsequently studied by Hopkins and Singer and by Witten, this intrinsic definition, and what they found was a topological obstruction to being able to define the 5 brain partition function. Okay? They found the topological obstruction. I'm now going to explain the physics of that topological obstruction. That's what this transparency is about. So, the remark is that if you're going to give an intrinsic definition to a 2-0 theory or to a little string theory, you have to be able to decouple the 5 brain from the bulk 11-dimensional M theory. And now, this theta class is the electric charge, and if it's not 0, then what that's saying is that a membrane has to come from the bulk and end on the 5 brain to cancel the charge. And if that happens, then obviously you cannot decouple the 5 brain from the bulk. So you expect from this simple physical picture that theta equals 0 is a necessary condition to decouple the 5 brain from the bulk and should be a necessary condition for a well-defined 5 brain partition function. And does it work? It does work. You see, if you have theta, then you can consider its push forward down to W, the integral around the four-sphere fibers. So that brings you down to a 4 form on W6. Now the G-flux the G-flex on the 10 manifold is the pullback of the G-flux on the 5 brain plus the global angular form that's there because you know you have a 5 brain induces a global angular form. And so this condition, the vanishing of the electric charge, implies first of all that the G-flux on the 5 brain is D of something, and you know that's true. In fact, D of the chiral fields of the field strength of the chiral 2 form is what trivializes the G-flux on the 5 brain. But even when this is satisfied, this can still be a non-zero torsion class. And that non-zero torsion class turns out to be exactly the class that was found by Witten and Hopkins and Singer as the class whose vanishing is necessary to define a 5 brain partition function. So this is the I found their condition somewhat mysterious. Their purely topological condition somewhat mysterious. And this is, for me, the explanation of that class. It's simply saying that it's a condition that you are allowed to have zero electric charge here so that membranes don't have to end on the 5 brain. And therefore, you can really decouple the 5 brain from the bulk 11-dimensional supergravity. Well, torsion, yeah. They're wrapping torsion cycles. Sure. Yeah. Okay. The third application is some further understanding of the relationship of the M theory to the K theory classification of Ramondremont fluxes. So again, this proceeds from the physical intuition that if theta equals zero guarantees that 2 brains don't end on 5 brains. Now, similarly, there's a condition that D brains don't end on a D brain wrapping a world volume W, and that's a condition that looks like this, square 3 plus H on the Poincaré dual of W is 0. And that leads to the K-theoretic classification of D brains. So we expect that theta equals 0 should also somehow descend to the K-theoretic classification of fluxes, and it does. So let's suppose that Y11 is S1 fibered over 10 manifold U10. So we can think about type 2 string theory on U10. And now let's let Y11 and U10 have boundaries. So the boundary of Y11 is X10. The boundary of U10 is V9. So we have this situation. We have Y, X10, Y11. This is S1 fibered over V9 and U10. So up here we have M theory, and down here we have type 2A theory. And I'm going to relate the vanishing of electric charge, of electric C field charge, here up on X10 to the the K theory classification of Ramondremont fluxes down here. So you see, if you have a if you have the characteristic class of a G field up in X10, then it's the pullback of the class of the G field from V9 plus the H flux times the circle class around the M theory circle. So you can now calculate theta of A, and you can integrate it along the circle, and that's some 7 class. And what that is morally is square 3 plus h on a minus a half lambda. Now that's only morally because in the presence of 2 torsion, it's illegal to divide by 2. And after all, square 3 is only interesting in the presence of 2 torsion. So what this really means is that the pi star of 2 theta is h times 2a minus lambda. And pi star of theta of a1 minus theta of a2 is square 3 plus h of a1 minus a2 bar. So that means that the vanishing of the theta class up here is giving you exactly the k-theoretic classification condition for fluxes, Ramon-Ramon fluxes downstairs. So that fits well, too. So this vanishing of this theta class does a lot of things for you. It unifies a lot of topological obstructions. Finally, let me talk about spatial boundaries. So far, I've been thinking about it as a boundary of fixed time. And I've been thinking about these wave functions as wave functions of the universe or something like that. And I've been talking about Gauss laws. But of course, I could also consider spatial boundaries, where we have something more like the Hoche-Witten picture. And then what we should do is impose not Gauss laws, but boundary conditions on the C field. Now, in the E8 model, a very natural boundary condition to take is that the pullback of the little C field is 0, pullback to the boundary. And this is an interesting boundary condition because it's clearly breaking that topological invariance that I had before. Remember, I said that the E8 gauge field was a topological gauge theory. They were not propagating E8 gauge fields in the 11-dimensional bulk. But if I impose such a boundary condition, then I break that topological gauge symmetry, but I still have the usual E8 gauge transformations, the bundle automorphisms. You see, those act by AC goes to A gauge transformed by GC. So if I put C equals 0, that's perfectly consistent with having ordinary E8 gauge transformations. And that means that while you cannot introduce F wedge star F as a gauge invariant term in 11 dimensions, you can introduce it on the boundary. So you can have dynamical E8 gauge fields on the boundary. Yeah?
Does that give any hint that such a term is fully generated?
Well, why shouldn't it be? Yeah. I mean, if you impose this, then there's there's no reason why it shouldn't be generated, say in loops, for example.
Yeah, but it's supposed to have a precise coefficient.
Well, okay. I haven't started with a theory and calculated quantum mechanical loops and produced such a coefficient. All I'm observing is that in this model, I'm not saying a lot, I'm observing that in this model I can have this picture that I've wanted of a topological gauge theory in the bulk. The E8 gauge field is not propagating. It's a topological degree of freedom in the bulk, becoming dynamical on the boundary. And this formalism gives a precise meaning to those words. It is you take the E8 model for the C field and you impose this boundary condition.
Do you think it might have
a what? A holographic interpreter? Well, it looks vaguely like that, but sure. I mean, to the extent that the Chern-Simons being in 3 dimensions being equivalent to rational conformal field theory on the boundary is a holographic, is an example of holography. It's similar. The point I want to make here is that this is actually, I stressed before that the bundle automorphisms were not a subgroup, but we're a subgroupoid. So I've never seen this before. I would like to call this spontaneous breaking of groupoids, not of groups. And in this way, you can incorporate both the Hoshava-Witten and the Favinter-Hoshava models. And now, going back to that interpretation of the phase on a manifold with boundary in terms of a section of a Pfaffian line bundle for the Dirac operator coupled to E8 gauge connections, you now see that the cancellation of E8 gauge anomalies in the Hoshava-Witten model is manifest and local. No need for bump forms or anything like that. It's precise on the nodes. The gravitational anomalies are much more subtle, and we're still thinking about that. Okay, so to conclude, there's a lot left to do. I hope, expect, that there will be some future applications of this formalism to various anomaly cancellation issues connected to five brains, G2 singularities, frozen singularities, and so on. It would really be nice for that such applications if we had a better way to compute theta. I gave a very abstract definition of theta. Theta was defined in terms of making some, you know, Dirac operator coupled to some E8 gauge field and taking its eta invariant and studying it as a homomorphism on the flat characters. My God, you know, so it is a definition, but it's hard to compute with that definition. I gave a few properties that allow you to compute in some situations. It would be nice to have a better control on this theta. It's a rather subtle object if you include torsion. There's a whole story I've suppressed here about the gravitino. So a gravitino in 11 dimensions is not well defined. And what you have to do is what is well defined is the product of the gravitino with the Chern-Simons phase. And understanding how that works in the case where you have a manifold with boundary is a little subtle. Then it would be nice to complete the derivation of K-theory from M-theory by comparing the actual wave functions of the type 2 in M-theory. And I showed you that the topological obstructions match nicely, but the actual completion of showing that the wave functions are really the same remains to be done, including supersymmetry. That's a very interesting problem. How do you include supersymmetry in this formalism? It's really not obvious. I should even say that including supersymmetrizing the CIA term is something which is not really well understood yet. And another challenging extension is the following. M-theory is parity invariant. Therefore, everything that I've said should be done when Y is unoriented and possibly even non-orientable. Now, I used eta invariants. I used orientations all over the place. But in principle, it should be done when Y is unoriented. And that certainly remains to be done. Of course, the main question here is what's the physical role of this E8 gauge field? And is it useful? And I've shown you a few applications, nothing stunning yet, but well, we'll see. Thank you.
If you just follow your notes and you would write down some Donaldson type topological field theory for the EA gauge field, do you get fields which somehow.
Is there a cohomological field theory associated with this? You see, the simplest action that's gauge invariant under the gauge invariants that I wrote is supergravity action. Because G, you see, is there a way to suppress that? The gauge symmetry twofold. And then there's the one for the now from this one, you see, I'm allowing an arbitrary shift of A. So trace of F wedge star F is no good. But G is trace of F squared minus 1/2 trace of R squared plus DC. And of course, this is how the gauge invariance was designed. The change in little c here is designed to cancel change here. So the simplest thing I can imagine is G wedge star G, but that's 11-dimensional supergravity. Sure. Another answer to your question is, one can dream that there's a limit. One can dream that there's a limit in which this goes away and you're left with a purely topological field theory. And now throughout the talk I was making an analogy to three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory. And in that case, where y is three-dimensional, there is a limit. It's the strong coupling limit, which is the same as the long distance limit, because G has units of mass. And so there's a very, very well-defined limit in which you recover a nice topological field theory. Unfortunately, the analogous limit here goes the wrong way. It's the short distance limit. And that's exactly where you shouldn't be trusting classical 11-dimensional supergravity. And indeed, this term is a topological field theory action looks a little problematic to me. For example, if you took it literally, then the symplectic form on field space is the curvature of that line bundle I was talking about. So it's G delta C wedge delta C. And that's very far from being a non-degenerate two-form on the space of C fields. So in contrast, in three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory, the symplectic form was delta A, and you can really do quantum mechanics with that.